Yeah, so the question is about the nature of merit and so difficulty with that term. Yeah, I have a problem with that term too, always have. So we tend to translate it as blessings, so that the chant that we'll do it later on today, the imina punya kamena, the Pali word is punya. So where are we? Page 26. When we did this translation, we put it into the English with the heading "the sharing of blessings." Generally, it's called sharing of merit, and precisely for those reasons that you described, that it feels like a commodity that you get, and oftentimes in Asia, people do relate to punya as some kind of celestial bank account. And like that's what Ajahn Chah would sort of hack away at. Like you're just using the monastic community as a kind of merit bank. You know, you just sort of go and as long as you get the stuff into the hands of the monk, then your account is going up. You know, and that's a good thing. As long as the object gets in the monk's bowl, then you know you're getting further into the black, and which is superstition. You know. And so that, just re-rendering it in terms of blessings, there isn't really a good English word that encompasses the Pali word punya. The English word boon, B-O-O-N, is related to punya.
I heard Joseph Goldstein when someone says, gives you good ideas, well, that doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That interpretation is good.
That has value, yeah. It's tricky because it's there. Sanjali Pala was just saying that when Joseph Goldstein says, like when you mention a good idea, you say, well, that has merit. So it's that whole domain of it has value or it has meaning, there's goodness that goes with it. So if it's mishandled, then it becomes this kind of celestial bank account. You're trying to accumulate this stuff. And I'll talk about that a little bit more. There's an interesting teaching which I have somewhere here in the a couple of teachings about merit. Maybe after we have the walking meditation, I'll go into this a bit more. But there's this description of this the Buddha in a previous life. He was a Brahmin called Velama, and he made this incredibly huge, generous offering. And then it goes through saying, "Well, that would be more, it would have been a more generous offering if it had been given to an enlightened being." And then just even giving to a sangha of totally enlightened beings headed by a Buddha is not as meritorious as practicing loving kindness for the time it takes to milk a cow, which is about 20 minutes. And this is, even more meritorious than that is to maintain the insight into anicca, into impermanence, for a finger snap. So that you know, sometimes, you know, and Ajahn Chah would make that sort of reflection, say, you want to make merit, you come here with this sort of cartload of stuff. If you really want to make merit, you know, practice meditation. Ooh. But that won't be real merit. No, it's more merit. The Buddha said you make more merit in having insight into an each of a finger snap than you do for cartloads of material offerings. Don't you believe me? Oh yeah, we believe you, Lumpur. Well, why don't you want to meditate? Well, it's not really merit, is it? Okay. So, you know, we can get really stuck on that idea of it's this stuff that you get in a particular way and you've got to build it up. But that's a mishandling of it. It's more like a it's more like a love of goodness and a like that love of goodness draws goodness to you, so that by so that cultivating wholesome qualities, then you make it more, you make wholesome things more attractive to you, and that you're drawn more to those are the choices that you make. So you can say that you're making merit or you're collecting merit. Actually, it's more like you're relinquishing confusion. You know, it's different ways of, it's like the glass being, you know, half full of merit, but, you know, half empty of confusion. So. Anyway, we can talk about it a little bit more in the afternoon, because it's helpful to understand. And then also the whole idea of transferring merit. People say, well, that's not canonical, that's just kind of superstitious nonsense. Even in the, from the time of the Buddha, he was talking about that. So anyway, we can have a period of walking meditation now. It's that mid-afternoon kind of steamy, droopy moment. So we can break for half an hour. So it's 2:35 now. So Richard, are you our bell ringer for the day?
So I'll ring at 3 o'clock. I'm sorry, what time do you want to come back for your...
If you ring it at... yeah, ring it at 3. Yeah, that'll be good.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato
Readings I wanted to give in relationship to these two elements of the sort of internal and external, the jiriki, tariki, self-power, other power side of things. It's kind of interesting that actually what was quoted in that Oxford Dictionary of Religions, World Religions, the Buddha's exhortation for us to be reliant upon ourselves. That's a this microphone is incredibly no it's great it's incredibly good just it's a bit loud if it's too close. Yeah. So that is a very famous quotation from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the discourse on the Buddha's last years, and this is a passage from that sutta. It's number 16 in the Long Discourses. Ananda, I am now old, worn out, venerable, one who has traversed life's path. I have reached the term of life, which is 80 years. Just as an old cart is made to go by keeping held together with straps, so the Tathagata's body is kept going by being strapped up. It's only when the Tathagata withdraws his attention from outward signs and by cessation of certain feelings enters into the signless concentration of mind that his body knows comfort. Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a monk live as an island unto himself, with no other refuge? Here, Ananda, a monk abides contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, and having put away all hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise with regard to feelings, mind, and mind objects. That, Ananda, is how a monk lives as an island unto himself, with no other refuge. And those who now in my time or afterwards live thus, they will become the highest if they are desirous of learning. Also, there's a debate has been, maybe not raging in the Buddhist world, an energized debate has been going for many years, more than 2,000 years, because the word for island is the same as the word for light, being Dipa. Like Dhamma Dipa means light of Dhamma or island of Dhamma. So is it being a light unto yourself or being an island unto yourself? But the Buddha was also extremely fond of double meanings and layered meanings, and so I suspect it's quite possible he deliberately chose an ambiguous word that means both light and island, as it works in both ways. You can take the symbolism both ways. So that great exhortation to be self-reliant is there. But however, a little later on in the same discourse, as just after the he'd given the instruction to Ananda about saying this is how a Tathagata, a Buddha, is honored and revered in the most supreme way, is by practicing the Dhamma. Shortly after that, then he talks about his own passing away, and also the cultivation of devotion. Ananda, there are four places the sight of which should arouse emotion, that is, the spiritual urgency in the faithful. What are they? Here the Tathagata was born is the first. Here the Tathagata attained supreme enlightenment is the second. Here the Tathagata set in motion the wheel of Dhamma, that's the third, and here the Tathagata attains the Nibbana element without remainder, that is the fourth. And Nibbana, the faithful monks and nuns, male and female lay followers, will visit those places, and any who die while making the pilgrimage to these shrines with a devout heart will, at the breaking up of the body after death, be reborn in a heavenly world. And then Ananda asks him, how should we look after the Buddha's remains? And the Buddha says, Ananda, the remains of the Tathagata should be dealt with like the remains of a wheel-turning monarch. And how is that, Lord? Ananda, the remains of a wheel-turning monarch are wrapped in new linen cloth, then wrapped in teased cotton wool, and then this in a new cloth. Having done this 500 times each, they enclose the king's body in an oil vat of iron, which is covered with another iron pot. Then, having made a funeral pyre of all manners of perfumes, they cremate the king's body and they raise a stupa at the crossroads. That, Ananda, is what they do with the remains of a wheel-turning monarch, and they should deal with the Tathagata's body in the same way. A stupa should be erected at the crossroads for the Tathagata, and whoever lays wreaths or puts sweet perfumes and colors there with a devout heart will reap benefit and happiness for a long time. And under there are four persons worthy of a stupa. Who are they? A Tathagata, an Arahant, fully enlightened Buddha, is one. A Pacheka Buddha, that's a Buddha who doesn't form a Sangha, that is one. A disciple of the Tathagata is one, and a wheel-turning monk is one. And why is each of these worthy of a stupa? Because Ananda had the thought, this is the stupa of a Tathagata, of a Pacheka Buddha, of a disciple of the Tathagata, of a wheel-turning monarch. People's hearts are made peaceful, and then, at the breaking up of the body, after death, they go to a good destiny and re-arise in a heavenly world. That is the reason, and those are the four who are worthy of a stupa. And even after that instruction about being an island, Ananda then, very equally famously, then the Venerable Ananda went into his lodging and stood lamenting, leaning on the doorpost. Alas, I'm still a learner with much to do, and the teacher is passing away who is so compassionate to me. And then the Buddha hears word of Ananda weeping and says, I'll tell Ananda to come over here. so then he very beautifully summons Ananda over and says, Ananda, you've done a lot of good stuff. You've been immeasurably helpful to me, and you've been the kindest, most attendant servant. You have done many, many good things. You have created incredible good karma. So if you apply yourself in no short time, you will indeed realize that Nibbana. So, and it actually wasn't until the night before the first council, 3 months after the Buddha's final passing, that Ananda had been told that he couldn't come to the council unless he was an arahant. And the other 499 who were there were all arahants. You can't come unless you're an arahant. And so this is also another great teaching story. So Ananda spent the whole night meditating, and then finally, just before dawn, and he hadn't made it, he gave up. And so they say, he said, well, I'm not gonna make it. The council's beginning tomorrow, and so there's no point in me carrying on, exhausting myself. And then it said, and between the time when before his head hit the pillow and after his feet left the ground, then the Venerable Ananda realized full and complete enlightenment. But it was the moment of giving up, then he finally made it. So amongst all his other accomplishments, Ananda is the one disciple who was enlightened outside of the four postures. He wasn't sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. So Ananda was unique in many, many respects. So I thought that was interesting how within the same teaching you have the Buddha saying, rely upon yourself, be an island to yourself. And then, go to the stupas, visit the places where the Buddha was enlightened, was born, passed away, and so on. But you have, yes, rely on yourself, and yes, go to these places and they will help you. And they're both side by side in the same teaching. And so just as the Venerable Xu Yun was pointing out that when John Blowthorpe says, well, why have you got these statues of Amitabha Buddha in your, in this Zen monastery? Huh? But these all work in together, and when we understand them in a good way, then when we're making offerings and bringing benefits and sort of making those gestures of, say, visiting stupas or paying respect to shrines, bowing to the Buddha image, that we're able to see that there's these different dimensions to it. Part of it is an external gesture, part of it is an internal piece of work, a piece of internal work as well. Another couple of things to say about offerings, And then I would like to go on to bowing and Anjali a little bit. But again, just as I mentioned this morning, I read that passage about how when we do the recollections of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, the Buddha describes how that helps one in terms of establishing the basis for meditation. Similarly, and also mentioned how that also occurs in a teaching of the Buddha about sila, that with virtue, when the heart is established in virtue, then similarly that becomes a basis for meditation. This is a little passage from the Vinaya describing an exchange between the Buddha and one of his chief women lay disciples, Visakha, who was the great mother, had 20 children, 10 daughters, 10 sons, and each of them, according to the stories, had 10 daughters and 10 sons. So she had she was a grandmother of 400. So she was the matriarch plus plus, and a very ardent disciple of the Buddha, had been a stream enter since the age of 7. And she was known as Migara's mother, even though Migara was her father-in-law. She was called Migara's mother because she was the one who introduced her father-in-law to the Buddha. So the Buddha said, "You're his mother in the Dhamma, so you should be called Migara's mother." So that's how she's generally known. Anyway, she asked the Buddha if she could make these 8 different kinds of offerings to the Sangha. And these included things like food for sick monks and nuns, food for traveling monks and nuns, providing food for a sick nurse, for monks and nuns, providing rice gruel in the mornings, providing bathing troughs for the nuns so they wouldn't have to be naked when they were bathing down at the river. And anyway, she asks for the permission to offer these 8 sets of things to the Buddha and his disciples. And the Buddha says, "But Visakha, what benefits do you foresee for yourself in asking the Tathagata for these 8 favors?" "As for that, Lord, bhikkhus who have spent the rains in different parts will come to Savati to see the Blessed One." That's where she was living. "They will approach the Blessed One and question him thus, 'Lord, the bhikkhu named so and so has died. What is his destination? What is his rebirth?' The Blessed One will tell how it is of that one who has reached the fruit of stream entry, once return, non-return, or arahantship. I shall approach them and ask, 'Lord, did that Lord ever come to Savati?' And if they answer that he did, I shall conclude that surely a rain's cloth would have been used by that bhikkhu, or visitor's food, or food for going on a journey, or food for the sick, or the constant gruel supply will have been used by that bhikkhu. When I remember it, I shall be glad. When I am glad, I shall be happy. When my mind is happy, my body will be tranquil. When my body is tranquil, I shall feel pleasure. When I feel pleasure, my mind will become concentrated. That will maintain the spiritual faculties in being, in me, and also the spiritual powers, and also the enlightenment factors. This, Lord, is the benefit I foresee in myself and asking for the 8 favors of the Tathagata." "Good, good, Visakha. It's good that you've asked the Tathagata for these 8 favors, foreseeing these benefits. I grant you the 8 favors." So that was very skillful of Visakha to see that it's not just been helping out the monastic community that those things are useful, but also the act of generosity, just as with virtue and with the recollection of the Buddhas, it provides this basic quality of ease and physical comfort, mental comfort, and the qualities that support concentration, and that leads to insight and liberation. So so today, being Ajahn Chah's birthday, he would have been, let's see, he was born in 1918, so he would have been 88 today, is that right? Yes, 06, isn't it? So this would have been his 88th birthday, where he's still alive. And so that one of the elements of devotional practice is that of what they call acharya puja, or devotion to the teacher. And in other countries, and particularly in the northern Buddhist tradition, particularly in Vajrayana, the what they call guru yoga, where you, there's a very systematized and emphatic way that you disciples are trained to hold the teacher in a very exalted position, actually even above the Buddha. You say that because the teacher is supposed to be the embodiment of the triple gem, so that actually your physical teacher is more important than the Buddha, because that's, he's like the Buddha's representative in the world. And so that they have a whole system of practices of guru yoga, where you you're visualizing your teacher and making offerings to your teacher in your meditation and so forth, and also ultimately seeing that the guru is not outside, but actually is only a manifestation of what is your own nature. And that's a very succinct summary. But in the Theravada world, it's not so systematized, but it's very much the same kind of a principle that they would never in the Theravada world, no Theravadan teacher that I know of would ever consent to themselves being thought about, let alone talked about, let alone depicted as being above the Buddha. They don't go for that piece of the imagery. Certainly that's how it functions on a day-to-day basis, that way of relating to the teacher from a position of gratitude and respect, and consciously cultivating that as a kind of part of the support for your spiritual life. And in the scriptures, in the Buddha's initial guidance with regards to the relationship between the teacher and the student. The Buddha describes this as in the establishing of the beginning of the ordination process and the establishment of the monk's order. The Buddha said that a preceptor, a monastic teacher, is one who that should arouse the attitude of a son, a child, to in their student. And the student should arouse in the precept the attitude of a father. So this is like a monk and a junior monk or a novice. And so thus these living with reverence, with deference, with courtesy to one another will come to growth, to increase the maturity in this Dhamma and discipline. So that it's and there's, it goes into many details about the range of duties that the student has towards the teacher and the teacher has towards the student. And that a couple of the interesting ones are that for the teacher, if the student is unwell, then the teacher should go out on alms round and collect food for the student. If the student is so sick they can't look after themselves, then the teacher should clean the student's room. They should actually do the laundry of their student. They should feed them, nurse them, take care of them. Just as a parent would look after their child in that way. And so that's the automatic duty of the teacher, even though they're in a sort of socially a superior position, they should not hesitate to take on those kind of ordinary roles in relationship to the student. And the one of the duties of the student to the teacher is if the teacher is sort of going off track, that is there, the Ajahn is getting deranged in some way, caught up in some building project, or is obsessed with some new piece of machinery, or is spending 15 hours a day with a particular lay disciple, that others are beginning to wonder out what's the nature of the relationship. Then it's the duty of the student to say to help the preceptor to see the error of their ways. It says, if wrong views have arisen in the preceptor, the student should dissuade him from them, or should get another to dissuade him from them. if the preceptor has committed an offence, then the then it's up to the student to sort of to help them go through the appropriate steps to make amends for that offence, and that the looking to ways to help keep the teacher on track and to look after them. So it's not presuming that there's a kind of the teacher is always in an elevated position and the student is the teacher's always right and the student's always wrong, which is what you tend to get within in some other models. But it's a very pragmatic sort of parent-child relationship, and just as we know in our own family, sometimes our parents go off and it's up to either physically or mentally, and it's up to the next generation to lend a hand, take care and support, and similarly for the parents, even though they're in a superior position, if the child really needs that kind of major hands-on care, even well into adulthood, it's the parents' obligation to lend a hand and to give. So that kind of quality of acharya puja and devotion to the teachers, and that quality of reverence, of service, of gratitude, it's a very powerful way of forming a sense of community and spiritual support, of kalyanamita, spiritual friendship. So one of the things people often remark on when they visit the different monasteries, particularly out of Ajahn Chah, and it certainly was striking to me, was how much people looked after each other. You know, we tend in the West to be very independent. Don't worry, I'm fine, I don't need anything. Leave me alone, I'll take care of myself. And we like that. But sometimes just allowing ourselves to be helped is kind of difficult, but it's also a very beautiful thing, and it also gives other people the opportunity to serve. And I found that when I was a young novice in Thailand, and I got the job of being the attendant to the abbot, I got a real buzz out of it. I really enjoyed that role of just being able to help and to support and to serve. And it didn't even matter that he had to be right all the time, but just the being able to be in that role of assisting and serving and being grateful for the job that the teacher had. It's just the fact that he was holding the wheel while the rest of us could sit in the back and argue and complain about the driving, but he's actually doing the driving. And that being grateful for that. So acharya puja, that kind of respect for the teacher. And also, it's not just I'm assuming you're not just confining this into the monastic field, but like for Gil and for the others who teach here and the different people that you all study with, that's a quality that we can cultivate. When we do the sharing of blessings, those of you who are not familiar with it, at the end of the day, the first one on the line, the first top of the line of who we share the punya, the blessings of our life with, is our spiritual teachers. Number one on the list. That's to whom we should be most grateful. So that's a kind of relationship that is worthy of looking into and supporting when we make efforts to cultivate that. And I'm not just sort of looking for, and I'm kind of embarrassed, like, oh, well, I'm in the role of teacher, and I'm telling everyone you should develop devotion to your teacher. So kind of, I'm not sort of fishing for cascades of rose petals or anything. But I'm just saying this is how it works, and it's a. Yeah, for some disciples it does take a while. How many years have you been? Sorry. So one can simmer with resentment for at least half a dozen years quite happily.
He can carry his own bag up the
stairs. Right. Yeah, one has to be prepared to go against all reason at times. The form demands it. Just like with the chanting, when you're saying, the Blessed One, the Noble Lord, and you're in your mind, you're cursing and swearing and resenting vigorously. Similarly, while you're carrying out your acts of devotion towards the teacher, you're thinking, yeah, why doesn't he do it himself? He can do his own buttons up. He can carry his own bag up. He's a big guy. He's bigger than me. And that it's a very good opportunity to just having that form to witness those, you know, the heat of righteous indignation. But I am right. He should do it himself. It's not fair. Oh, look at that. And we are, again, using a devotional form that if we're skillful, we'll actually be developing wisdom through the effect of that, trying to apply that practice. So that one of the the things that occurs, or when you take on monastic training and formalizing the relationship between the teacher and the student, is and some of you might be familiar with this, or seen this happening a few times, is a little ceremony called taking dependence, where you formally ask someone to be your teacher, acharyo me bante hohi, so that you ask someone to be your teacher. And then also asking for forgiveness comes after that. But start asking someone to be your teacher, taking dependence, called nisaya. This is a way of establishing that sense of commitment. Okay, I would like you to be my teacher. I would like to take nisaya. I would like to take dependence on you. And then when the teacher agrees, the person agrees, okay, I agree to be your teacher. Okay, I'll take on that relationship. Then, you do this three times over. You say, upaikang, that is suitable. Pati rupang, that is appropriate. Pasadikena sampadehi, let us proceed with mindfulness. Sadhu, sadhu. So you make that commitment, and then the next thing that the disciple says is Achatage Dani Tero Mayhang Paro Ahampi Teraksabaro. From this day on, I will be the burden of the elder, and the elder's burden will be mine. And that's always strikes me as a very beautiful way of establishing this kind of relationship of meaning, I will be the burden of the elder. Now it's your job to teach me, and I will try not to be recalcitrant and difficult and indignant at your instructions. But that's my intention. I will attempt to be a student, but I know I'm going to be a burden to you. And then the elder's burden will be mine. It's like, yeah, well, I will carry your bag up the hill, and I will do your laundry, and I will wash your arms bowl. So it's a forming of a connection, just as in any kind of relationship, like taking on a responsibility as a teacher, or in a marriage, or kind of taking a group of people, if you're sort of a group leader off on some kind of school trip or whatever. But okay, we ready for this? Do we know what we're doing? Okay, we're in this together. And so that even though there is that sense of reverence and looking up to and a gratitude to the teacher, there's also in that very gesture, there's the teacher's contribution is I'm ready to be. Take responsibility for you. So it's not just the one-way thing, which is one of the things I wanted to put across with that. It's not just a kind of slavish devotion to, and you're getting, there's nothing happening on the other side. But part of the mixture, it's like a deal that's made. It's like, not just I will, your burden will be mine, but I will be your burden as well. And so that it's like an agreement that you make together, so that sense of reverence and devotion is a kind of supported by a connectedness. And there are the such an occasion as today, as in Charles' birthday, then by now it's already 3:30 in the afternoon here, so it's 6 o'clock in the morning in Thailand. So they would have been up all night giving Dhamma talks. So it's just now dawn has broken and they're just probably getting geared up or out on their arms round after having been up all night hearing Dhamma talks. But that is how, you know, Ajahn Chah's birthday would be celebrated, gathering together and then practicing meditation, listening to Dhamma talks. But people would also, the lay community, would come and bring offerings to the monastery. So that 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 element of coming together and joining as a community and consciously acknowledging your association with others. Like also when I was there in January, the first time I'd been back in Thailand for about 10 years, and on the death, Ajahn Chah's death anniversary is also a time when everyone gathers. And we took a group of, speaking of group tours, we took a group of people from here. There are a group of lay ministers and their friends and partners. A group of about 16 went with Ajahn Pasana and myself, Ajahn Siddhanta, to Thailand in January. And we went to Ajahn Chah's monastery and had meetings there, and were there for this festival. And it was really a wonderful occasion, because they have, it lasted several days, and the culmination is his death anniversary on 16th of January. But the group of the lay ministers, the Calm group, Community of Abhayagiri Lay Ministers, Calm, the acronym. They had their own inspiration. They thought, well, we're going there, and it's Ajahn Chah's death anniversary, and they have this big gathering, and you know, we've been taken around Thailand and visiting all these great teachers, but you know, we want to participate in that. We don't necessarily want to be on the kind of receiving end, but what can we give to it? And so Ajahn Pasana and I thought about it a bit, and well, they have these free food kitchens. Maybe it wasn't even Ajahn Pasana or I that thought of it, but maybe someone who'd been there and sort of knew that that's what happens at these Ajahn Chah events, because there's thousands of people come, but nothing is ever sold, and people need to eat. So what happens is the different branch monasteries sponsor free food kitchens. So every year, different groups will come from all over, different branches from around the country, and they set up these food stalls, and they just give away food and drink for the period of the festival. And so in January, I think there was about 80 of the food stalls. Anyway, the Calm group decided they wanted to have their own food stall. So we'd sponsored them before from overseas, but never actually had actual foreign people manning the stations, and usually local people that were sort of doing it in the name of Abhayagiri. But on this occasion, the Calm group had got it together to not only man the kitchen themselves, but they've been exchanging emails vigorously on discussing what should be offered at the stalls, and they settled on funnel cakes. And some of us didn't even know what a funnel cake was. A funnel cake. So, for those of you who don't know, a funnel cake, the funnel of a funnel cake, imagine this is a jug. It's a jug with a spout on it that has got filled with a sort of gooey, eggy, buttery, sugary mix. And then you have hot fat in a big wok, and you pour the juice out of the funnel into the wok, and then you sort of move it around, and it makes a little knot of gooey, fried batter. That you then cooks very quickly, and you fish it out, and then you cover it in more sugar. And apparently these are parts of America where these are very common. That's what you have at the county fair, funnel cakes. So anyway, funnel cakes were finally agreed upon. And I thought, oh, you know, Northeast Thai people are really fussy about their food. It's going to be really difficult. You know, anything they've never seen before, they're not going to like. And I was slightly dreading the fact that they were going to, there's all this, you know, all of the emails and buying pounds and pounds and pounds of eggs and flour and all this stuff they were getting together when we were there in Thailand. Oh, this is going to be really disappointment. Then after the first day of the stall being set up, reports came back. Their queues are like 100 feet long. But they're the most popular stall. What? And sure enough, when Ajahn Pasana and I went over a day or two later, because it was several days, was it three or four days? Yeah, 3 or 4 days. They had the stall going. And so Ajahn Pasana and I went over to go and sort of see and kind of cheer things along. And sure enough, there was two queues forming in front of the funnel cake stall. And it was, and they're local village, local Thai, Northeast Thai villages were queuing up, the old and the young, and everybody, this is amazing. And then And the whole Abhayagiri, the calm group with their calm aprons were lined up, and it was really wonderful. Everyone was so happy. And then we found out, they said, well, why are so many of you queuing up here at the food store for the foreigners? He says, is it because of their cakes are so good? He says, well, actually, we're just really interested to see the foreigners working. We never saw foreigners doing any work before. They're either sort of in the monastery meditating, or they're kind of walking around the tourists with cameras, but we've never seen a foreigner work before. And so just seeing all these white people with aprons and getting, you know, up to their elbows in flour and batter and so on, it was great. But the cakes were pretty good too, so they weren't just buying them, I mean, there was no money exchange. They weren't just sort of tossing them away. They were going down very rapidly. They were very popular items. And it was very lovely to see this kind of Acharya Puja. This is like an offering that Ajahn Chah, and gratitude for his teaching and his life, that not to just be in a state of reception or receiving and sort of going, but also to embody that gratitude by an act of giving. And it was really marvelous to see how it worked out. I really couldn't believe my eyes, but it really is the longest queue, the right here, the calm stall. And that it was wonderful to see that kind of exchange, that in the we respond to the kind of gifts of our teachers and our mentors, those who have provided the spiritual guidance and the source of our spiritual welfare, that one can there are many ways that one can give back to that. I wouldn't have thought funnel cakes, you know, wouldn't have come up with, you know, the first thing I thought of, but there it was. You can see everyone was benefiting so much, and it was a treat for the kids. You could see it was going to be the talk of the region for months to come. Like, yeah, these sarangs, they're so tall, you know, enormous. And it was so that kind of just that field of blessings. When we talk about like a field of merit, punya keta, in the chant that we do, the unsurpassed field of blessings for the world, the punya keta, field of blessings, so that one sees that a great teacher, a wonderful master like Ajahn Chah, is like a field of blessings, so that just their life becomes a fertile ground whereby interreacting, you know, entering into that field, that fertility comes forth as so much goodness and blessings, benefit comes out of it for different people. So in that, I thought part of what I might like to instruct, you know, and do a little bit this afternoon is the art of speaking about Anjali. This is this gesture, Anjali, most people are familiar with, and then bowing. Because I know there's a great resistance to bowing. I don't bow to anybody, not because I'm, you know, either because we're Jewish or because we're American, or it's because. Don't bow to anything or anybody. But it's actually, even within the Jewish tradition, someone pointed out, actually, you know, they bow to the Torah. It's not like you don't bow to anything. Even Jewish people bow to the Torah. So, you are different. No, it ain't. And that kind of quality of composure that it brings, and that, as I was mentioning earlier today, that the way that it's like a physical expression of a spiritual intention of marking the fact that, you know, even though my ego tends to want to be in charge of everything and sets the rights and wrongs of the universe in place, at this moment I put the I generator, the thinking mind, and these habits, I place that down in a gesture of deference to wisdom, to truth, to virtue. And that when we actually bow from the heart, there's a and we notice there's a very beautiful feeling that that kind of resistance after, well, I don't agree, and well, just, well, right or wrong, let's just try this. And then just that gesture of all that I-ness, me-ness and my-ness, and all that rightness, just being able to let that my rightness be put aside, and just to bow to the way things are, is it's like a surrendering to Dhamma. Surrender, that's bad. But it's a maybe surrender is not the right word. Maybe like maybe the word yield is better. So surrender sounds like a contest that we've lost. Even though in the Indian tradition, surrender is seen as a very high spiritual quality, panidana. But that yielding of, or even in the traffic signs you have when you come up to an intersection, it says this yield. So, because you want to stay alive, and you respect the others, the rights of the others to share the road. Therefore, yield. Not, you know, get out of your car and go home, or that driving is bad, or that you have no right to be here, but yield. And then we all get to where we want to go to. So it's in that respect, that readiness to just let the self-concern be put aside. There's also a wonderful saying of in Lao Tzu, in the Tao Te Ching, when two unstoppable forces meet, victory will go to the one that knows how to yield. Interesting. If we don't know how to yield, we'll be like the tree that breaks in the wind. It's the one that can yield is like the tree that bends in the wind. So Anjali, there are different ways of describing it. So now probably this is old news to everybody, but I'll spend a moment on this. So the way that we make Anjali is to bring the hands together, fingers together, upright like that, and then to bring the hands together at the heart center like that, and then to greet someone or to bow, and we just simply bring the heads down to meet the hands, so that the tips of the fingers just touch the forehead. So, and so Anjali in Pali, A N with a tilde, J A L I, Anjali. And it's a kind of, I mean, I think it's a universal gesture. I was really surprised when my first day in the monastery, even though I resisted Church of England Christianity with great vigor, and when we were supposed to pray, I never knew what we were supposed to be doing, but I did, I always kind of liked putting my hands together to pray, even though I resisted all of the Bible and the authority of the church and the priest and everything. I kind of liked that gesture, and I remember the very first time I joined in with the chanting at Wat Phanamachat, when I was a sort of hairy hippie off the beach, and we all kind of got, and there was the evening chanting, and all the monks sort of kneeled up and put their hands together. Oh, well, that was the one bit I liked of my sort of Christian ritualism. That was the one bit I could stomach, was that gesture. I thought, oh, that's nice. So then bowing, I will try and demonstrate from the floor here.
So I hope everyone can see. So there are two basic ways you can bow, and that this is again of the Thai tradition. Either up on your toes, like this, which takes a bit of exercise to get the toes to comply like that. So I don't know exactly why, but they say men should bow up on their toes like that, but women down on their feet like that. I don't know why. But whatever is comfortable is okay. So either kneeling down like that with the feet on the ground or up on the toes, like that, whichever is comfy.
So then you have the knees slightly apart, not kind of at sort of 2 feet, just maybe a couple of hand widths apart, so that they're sort of forward from the hips, and then holding the hands in Anjali, just at the chest. Then you begin by bringing the hands up to the forehead, elbows kind of not flying out like wings, but down the sides, just sort of bring the hands up to the forehead, and then leaning forward, the hands sort of going down with us, and then the hands proceeding, and then landing with about a palm's width apart and the elbows at the knees, then the back is kept straight and the forehead touches the ground between the hands. So the hands are about yay far apart, so they're not together, and they're not a foot apart, which is like that. And then so the heads are neatly pitched down in between the two hands, and trying to keep the back. And you have to remember a lot of different things, like, you know, playing the piano or driving a car, you've got all kinds of things doing all different operations. So you're trying to keep the back straight so that your backside doesn't go flying up in the air. Keep your backside on your heels, back straight, and then the head going down between the hands. So that it's called the 5-point prostration. So that the feet, the knees, the head, and the hands all are kind of touching the ground. So that's and then we do it 3 times, one each. And in case sometimes people have been doing this fear, they say, why do you bow 3 times? So once for the Buddha, once for the Dhamma, once for the Sangha. That's why the three bows. And then on the last one. Then as you come up, then you just bring the hands to the head, so the one is sort of bent down to finish the last one. So that it goes like this. Approved bow, the Thai / Abhayagiri style. So it takes a bit of doing before we remember all the different elements. But it sometimes in spiritual practice, when your meditation is difficult or impossible, or when your mind is in a complete crisis, you're having a kind of meltdown, you know, reason has deserted you, or your mind is out of control, there's some major emotional stress, you're having some kind of huge fight or crack up. And this is, you know, you might think, well, obviously he's talking about lay life. Talking about as much about monastics as anybody else. Like Ajahn Sumedho in his early years in England, when they were, had just come from Thailand, and he had inherited the abbotship of the Hampstead Vihara in London, which had already been through you know, 3 very significant senior incumbents. The Venerable Kapalawada, who founded the place, Ananda Bodhi, who was a Canadian, highly eccentric Canadian monk, who is now called Namgyal Rinpoche, and does amongst other things, underwater retreats in shark-infested seas. I'm not kidding. He's a very eccentric teacher. Sangharakshita, who went on to found the Western Buddhist Order. So the Hampstead Vihara had been through a few interesting characters, and then Ajahn Sumedho inherited it, and then he found himself not only away from Ajahn Chah, away from the forest, away from his little hut, and living in the middle of London in a cramped house, and in a, with a monastery committee that was massively dysfunctional, both dysfunctional and fighting simultaneously. Fighting effectively, but communicating dysfunctionally. And he was right in the middle of it. And this, so there were times of incredible difficulty. And he would describe how sometimes he would just go up to the shrine room and just in the middle of the night just bow. Just go up to this, and there's no explanation, no plan, no solution possible for this thing he was in the middle of, and he would just go and bow, or just kind of kneel in front of a shrine and not be meditating or anything, just to go and to bow. And so sometimes that's this kind of, and you might think, well, that's a sort of escapist nonsense, and you know, we can do better than that, insight is the true way. But sometimes, yeah, insight just doesn't cut it, because when there's a sort of the difficulty is on the emotional level. Sometimes we need to answer it with an emotional cure, emotional medicine, rather than a rational medicine or a sometimes you don't need a scalpel, you need a backhoe. Right? We have been doing a lot of earthwork at the monastery. We laid 8,000 paving stones in 3 weeks, running up to our open day, or our exhausted day. No, it was open. It was open day, not exhausted day, wasn't it? My skin's just coming back under my fingers. Yeah, I think we're all just recovering. So sometimes those are the tools that we need, are the backhoes and the pneumatic drills. We don't need the laser torch and the scalpel. And so those kind of times, this sort of devotional practice and these qualities, and also the connection with the teacher, just to be able to see a picture of Ajahn Chah or the Buddha or whoever our teacher might be, just to see that picture, then it reminds us, oh, despite all of this difficulty and this kind of pressure, all these demands that are being made on me, or this feeling I can't deal with, or this impossible situation that I've somehow got myself written into, wisdom is possible. There are beings in this world who are utterly free, who have freed themselves. That is doable. And then that reflects factors, that touches our intuition, that this particular difficulty or demand or challenge that is being experienced, this isn't the whole story. This can't be the whole story. And so we find that quality of encouragement, our faith, is supported. And so faith, sadha, is not a kind of blind belief, but it's more confidence in the implications of what we already know, like trusting, that readiness to trust that we can do it, and not blindly trusting that, but being able to be strengthened by our own intuition that yes, it's doable, that this is doable. Even if we don't have evidence to prove it, that faith is that confidence in yes, this is a way forward, and let's try this. I'm ready to try, ready to risk, ready to bear it. So it can be tremendously supportive to have that kind of comfort, if you like. I mean, it is an other power in some respects. Like when you're all falling apart and you're remembering the Buddha or remembering the teacher and then being encouraged by that. But also one of the going back again to this self-power, other power, self-power dichotomy is that when you go to the teacher or you or you would, you speak in that way, and you try to ascribe to the teacher, well, you know, you're the one who's gonna, who can help me, you're the one who sort of can rescue me, then when the teacher, you know, at certain times, like the mother will allow the infant monkey to hang on. But I spent a lot of time watching monkeys in India last year. And sometimes the mother will go, get off, you know, you can walk on your own, you're too big, come on. You're too big to hang on, look after yourself. And then the little one goes, what? Oh, alright. And then they make their own way. And so sometimes the teacher will say, okay, you know, you can hang on. And then sometimes they'll just like a mother will say, do it yourself. You can you can look after yourself. You're big enough. And then at that kind of time, the teacher will say, it's not me, it's you. Look, you know, you're the one who can help yourself. Don't think it's me. And so that a teacher who needs the students to be praising them is not a teacher to be trusted. You know, a teacher who wants the students to be dependent on them is not to be trusted. A teacher who allows people to be dependent, you know, for a certain time, certainly that's fine and good. But when there's a certain when it's not a time of crisis or difficulty or dependency, then it's important for the teacher to be able to say, you know, you are the teacher. You know, that's that. It's in your nature. You are actually the one who teaches yourself. And don't look at me, look at yourself. And so that in the same way that we can, you know, look at in the chanting, the words of the chanting talk about the Buddha as an external person. As I was saying, it, we can look at it as, you know, the blessed oneness, or the blessed awakenedness. Yeah. Rather than the blessed one of the person, the blessed awakenedness, the blessed oneness of our own nature that we're referring to. Similarly, with a physical teacher, personal teacher, it's like if that teacher is wise, then they'll help lead us back to that recognition that the real teacher is our own wisdom. And there's a little booklet. Unfortunately, we haven't got many copies. I would have bought a bunch to give away, but it's called No Ajahn Chah, which is a collection of aphorisms. And the title of the book comes from a couple of exchanges that are recorded there, where one person came to see Ajahn Chah one day, and they said, "Who is Ajahn Chah?" And he says, "This one. I'm Ajahn Chah." And then another day, a different student came and asked the same question. And he said, who is Ajahn Chah? And Ajahn Chah said, there is no Ajahn Chah. He doesn't exist. If you think there's an Ajahn Chah, you're lost in wrong view. There is no Ajahn Chah. And then someone, one of the monks said, well, how come you said to this, you know, to the first one, there is no Ajahn Chah, there is an Ajahn Chah, but you said, this is me. The second one, you said, there isn't one. Well, the first one had a shallower understanding, and that was appropriate for him. That, you know, I'm this person. You know, I'm the teacher here. And the second one said, had a more profound understanding. So that's why I said there is no Ajahn Chah, because they could understand that. They could receive that. They could learn from that. So. Actually, I just the last thing I'll say, I'll recount an experience that I had that I've often talked about. It was very, very powerful. Symbol, really. On my 10th rains retreat, I had a 3-month solitary time of seclusion in the forest in one of our monasteries in England. And during that time, there were several people close to the monastery who were very ill. Two of the major lay women supporters both had cancer. And there was another monk who had Crohn's disease who was very ill. That was a good friend of mine. And Ajahn Chah, who also just had been sick for about 5 or 6 years. And so every day, I had this little kind of puja that I would do, and sort of sending forth loving kindness and good wishes and sort of healing thoughts and so forth to this group. So that the first, and I did it quite systematically. And so when I brought these two women, Nori and Mudita, to mind, then I could see their faces quite clearly. That they, when I would think of their names, and their some mental image would come up quite clearly. And then when I thought of this monk who was sick, then he would be a little bit hazier. And then when I tried to think of Ajahn Chah, it would just like, there would be no mental image would come up. My mind would just go incredibly bright and clear. And there would be this profound feeling of, like, who do you think you are healing? Who is helping who in this business? And it was kind of every time, it was just sort of where for the first two, that was, you know, you could relate much more on a personal level. It was, you know, there's me here and there's you there, and I'm sending this good feeling to you. And then the second layer, there's like this monk, it was kind of tentative. And then the third one, Ajahn Chah, it's like, Ajahn Chah, where's he? What is an Ajahn Chah, and where do you think he might be, and what do you think he might need? And it was extraordinary, because every day this was repeated, you know, the same kind of, and I wasn't sort of inventing it. It was just, I was curious about it, but it happened every time, that the trying to see the Ajahn Chah of a person, you know, kind of personalize that. It just wouldn't, the mind wouldn't kind of formulate that. But it kept reflecting back to, like, well, don't just see things in these self-oriented ways. That, you know, the picture is bigger than that. Don't be presumptuous. Where is the reality? You follow what I mean? Yeah. And so it was a very strong reflection in that it was. And in that same as that, the no Ajahn Chah teaching, where is the real Ajahn Chah? Yeah. Where is that? And that it was, we said, well, if he's an enlightened being, if he's an embodiment of the Dhamma, and then if the Dhamma is everything, if that's the nature of my mind and everybody's mind, then where is Ajahn Chah not? Oh. And what does awareness mean anyway? You know, how can we talk about geography, really? Oh. And so then it was a really interesting experience of, yes, there's a devotion to the person and a gratitude to the person, but then that, when that was really receiving what that person embodied and had to offer, then it came back to say, oh, it's an illusion to just think in terms of personhood. And so that devotion to the other, to the teacher, then helped to break up the feelings of self-view, sakaya-ditti, and to support that quality of insight right then and there. So this is like true devotion to the teacher, is recognizing that the teacher isn't there. But it helps you to let go of the teacher. That's why I find when teachers tend to not necessarily promote themselves, but allow a kind of personality cult to form around them, and cultivate that sense of people devoting themselves to them in a very personalized way, I get this sort of uncomfortable feeling. But when someone who's in that role of being a leader or a teacher is always saying, "Don't look at me, look at yourself. Don't make a big thing out of me. Just look to yourself." Then I feel kind of inspired and gladdened, and an instant sort of that kind of open and delighted quality arises. So I'm not sure if we call that the formal ending.